Welcome to The Value of Knowing, the podcast where we dive deep into the world of legal complexity and opportunity on the vibrant continent of Africa. Stay tuned for expert insights and a closer look at the legal landscape in Africa, where Bowmans helps its clients to manage legal complexity and unlock opportunity. That's The Value of Knowing.
My name is Chris Todd. I'm a partner at Bowmans, and I'm delighted to be able to facilitate the first of two episodes that we're going to talk about the duties of directors, in particular what those duties are in relation to employees, and maybe a bit scarily, what we do when things go wrong. I'm very pleased to introduce Graham Demant, who is one of those long-standing lawyers of the firm who has advised many boards over many years, too many years for me to probably say publicly. And as a result, I think is a perfect person for us to talk to on the topic of directors' duties. Today's focus is going to be on what those duties are. It's a bit scary being a director of companies when you get told how many things you need to know about. But let's turn to you, Graham. Welcome. Thanks so much for agreeing to talk to us today. And maybe we can kick off just telling us why we care, and then secondly, how we work out what directors' duties are, what they really need to know about on questions of employment.
Hi, Chris. Now, as you're aware, we are most often called upon to advise boards of directors when they face some sort of major issue or a crisis, and it usually involves the conduct of the chief executive or another senior executive, and it usually involves a situation where the company faces either reputational harm or potentially a regulatory consequence. But, you know, as you're aware, a company is made up of the people who work in it, and their conduct to each other and their conduct to outsiders can cause material harm to a company, and sometimes that harm can be actually irreparable. You only have to think of a couple of the cases where chief executives have behaved badly, and the consequence being is that the company is in deep trouble. You think of Harvey Weinstein overseas and that whole harassment issue that resulted in the Me Too movement, what damage that did to his company. You think of Marcus Juster and what happened to Steinhoff. You will also have seen that Abercrombie and Fitch are currently facing a number of claims for sexual harassment because of the conduct of its former chief executive, and are also being investigated by the FBI. You can also think of a whole lot of the other big name companies that have been involved in the state capture project and what that's done to their reputations. You think what happened to Arthur Andersen with the Enron scandal. So essentially what you've got is a situation where a senior executive behaves badly. It can be either bad behavior to other employees, like a sexual harassment type situation, or it can be in relation to accounting scandals, or it can be in relation to what they do with outsiders, such as corrupt conduct that has a material consequence. And that's usually where we get called in by boards to advise.
I mean, Graham, I don't know if you're reeling off that list to try and scare people who might be listening to this podcast and say to people, be careful about being a director because the range of possible problems that you could be facing with governance oversight in a company is quite wide. But I guess the real question is, well, we get called in when there's a crisis, but what do directors actually need to know that will help them sort of mitigate or manage that? And maybe that's really the starting point that we need to turn to, which is, you know, how much do I have to know? I think directors, certainly many that I speak to, are already somewhat overwhelmed with the wide range of different sort of areas of law and regulation that they have to be qualified to speak to. What are the kind of laws and regulations that affect people that they need to know about?
There's quite a lot of guidance out there to directors in relation to how they need to conduct themselves in relation to employment issues. I'd suppose the best guidance comes from the King Code of Corporate Governance, which sets out the duties of directors. Now, while the King Code is not law, it certainly will provide guidance to any court that is required to assess whether the directors did their job or not. So, you know, provided you're sort of complying with those guidance principles that are set out in King, A director should be able to say, well, I did what was required of me in relation to understanding what was needed for employment law, and I did what was needed for me to understand what I needed to do in relation to employment.
What does the King Code tell us we need to know then about employment law?
I've identified sort of six major themes that you can pick up in the King Code that deals with employment issues. And if I were to take those themes and just set them out very broadly, the first is knowledge of employment law and the regulatory environment and ensuring compliance with those laws. So the directors need to know all the laws that are applicable to a company. I'm going to be just focusing on the employment laws and regulations that they need. There's a big focus in King on ethics, and the board's requirement to set the ethical direction of a company. And that obviously has material employment consequences because all of that ethical direction relates to employee behavior. The board then needs to appoint the chief executive, and it needs to oversee the appointment of other senior executives to make sure that they've got the requisite competencies. They've got to delegate authority to the chief executive and other executives in a clear manner. They've got to evaluate the performance of the CEO. And then finally, and a big issue is the question of remuneration, that they've got to deal with remuneration.
Yeah, that's a popular topic, and it attracts a lot of public scrutiny and attention, pay. And everybody's very interested in pay. Obviously, I have to come to that. I think, though, Graham, it sounds as though we need to talk about each of those areas in a bit more detail. I think somebody listening and hearing you say a director needs to know all of the laws applicable to the company, and then just one subset of that is all the employment laws. By itself, that sounds like quite a scary proposition. You know, can you kind of unpack and help us to sort of understand what realistically does a director need to know about employment laws?
All you'd really need to know is the four major principal pieces of legislation that apply to the company and that govern employment law. And you'd need to know the key features of those insofar as it's applicable to a board. But you wouldn't need to know the detail, for instance. You wouldn't have to go and read the entire piece of legislation. You just simply need to know the broad parameters of what it covers. And I'd say, most importantly, you would need to know when to ask for advice. So you'd need to know that there's a law out there or something that you should be concerned about, and you need further advice in relation to that applicable law.
Okay, so Graham, let's talk about what those laws are. I'm all the time being conscious of not wanting to scare people off taking these important roles. Which are the laws that directors actually need to know about, and what do they say?
Yeah, so there are four major pieces, but there are obviously other laws that affect employment, like tax laws, compensation for occupational injuries. I'm just going to focus on the four, and I'm going to start with the Labor Relations Act, which I think is probably the sort of most fundamental piece of employment legislation. And essentially, all that the directors would need to know about that law, because as you know, it's a substantial piece of legislation. The Labor Relations Act governs collective bargaining, and it allows for the establishment, for instance, of bargaining councils in particular industries, where you'll then have bargaining done at sector level as opposed to company level. Directors would simply need to know, what are the bargaining arrangements applicable to the company? Are you part of a bargaining council, and is bargaining conducted at sectoral level, or do you have bargaining arrangements in-house? So that would be the first issue.
Just for those who might not know, Graham, collective bargaining is really talking about relationships between a company and trade unions, I suppose.
Correct.
Which presumably means that's going to worry you if you're in a business or running a factory or an industry where there is a unionized workforce, or they work because you belong to unions. Is that the only time that you would worry about that?
That's correct. I mean, if you're in a non-unionized environment and you don't have any kind of bargaining arrangement, you wouldn't then be concerned about, you know, how wages are being set for your particular company, because that would then become a discretion issue for the board and the executive to determine the remuneration, as opposed to being imposed on you by external bargaining arrangements. The other thing that I think the board would need to be aware of about the Labor Relations Act is that it does govern dismissals for retrenchment and dismissals for strikes. A mass dismissal of a large number of employees could obviously have material implications for the company, so that I think the board would need to be advised in the event that the company was contemplating a mass dismissal. The only time that the board would become directly involved in a dismissal is if it was contemplating the dismissal of the chief executive. And in that case, it would need to know that the LRA governs unfair dismissals and requires that there's both a substantive reason for a dismissal and a fair procedure that is followed in relation to that dismissal. So they need to be aware that you don't simply go in and fire the chief executive. You have to follow a process and there's got to be a substantive reason. And that would be an instance where, for instance, the board may take advice. And that's very often where we get called in relation to advice on the termination of employment of a CEO.
I suppose that's the flip side of the obligation to appoint a chief executive, which I think you said is one of the king obligations, is if you're going to get rid of your chief executive, same point. It's the board that has to take responsibility for that.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay.
And then the final issue in the LRA that the board would need to be aware of is that the board often has to deal with issues of variable pay. And the LRA has got a provision in there that categorizes as an unfair labor practice, unfair conduct in relation to a benefit. Now, a benefit would include variable pay. So when the board comes to deal with variable pay, its actions can be scrutinized as being an unfair labor practice. So they need to just simply be aware that when they deal with variable pay, it may be governed by the LRA. So that, I'd say, are the broad issues that a board would need to be aware about on the LRA.
Sounds fair enough. What else do we need to worry about?
So the next piece of legislation is the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, but that simply sets minimum standards, like what are the maximum hours that you can work, when is overtime payable, what leave must be given, maternity leave, sick leave, normal leave, severance pay. It deals with all of those kind of minimum standards. The board would not need to know all of that, but it would simply need to know that there is that law there and would want some form of assurance from the executives that the minimum standards are being complied with.
Okay. And I imagine in South African environment, most people would know that we have something called an Employment Equity Act, or at least that prohibitions on discrimination and other kinds of regulation of this in the workplace are important. It's certainly been in the media a lot. We've heard a lot about targets for different demographic targets in the workplace and so on and so forth. How's that regulated? And does a board have to know about that?
Yeah, I'd say probably that's one of the most important principal pieces of legislation that a board would need to be aware of, because the non-compliance with the Employment Equity Act can have serious consequences for a company, both in terms of penalties and in terms of the contracts that it is awarded by government and by other private companies that are seeking to comply with their own BEE requirements. But what the Employment Equity Act requires is that every company which employs more than 50 employees has an employment equity plan in order to try and redress historical imbalances in the makeup of your workforce. And they've got to then put in reports in terms of their compliance with that particular plan. The board would need to be assured that there is a plan in place, and it would need to be advised of the company's compliance with that plan so that you know where the company is in relation to employment equity at any point in time. And similarly, as the board has got an oversight role in the appointment of the executive committee and the executive members, I think the board would be interested to know the composition of that exco in relation to its employment equity targets. So I think those are fundamentally important because, as I say, the consequences of non-compliance can be material.
I think one of the things I find interesting looking across the world and comparators in this area is that South Africans sometimes think that these are uniquely South African, and no doubt there are some uniquely South African parts of our employment equity legislation, but diversity and inclusion at board level and executive level is a key issue for companies across the world. And the simple point is that there's an increasing amount of research suggesting that well-balanced boards from the point of view of gender and other forms of identity, diversity, kind of seem to take more reasonable or more, I don't know if you'd say, more business-like approaches. Graham, is there anything that you'd sort of comment on that? I mean, it seems to go beyond the law into something a little bit, some of the softer issues around governance of companies.
Look, there's no doubt that what you say is exactly correct. But here we've got a legislated requirement beyond any form of kind of moral or what is best for the company requirement. And that goes to our history and our very unique history that we've got in this country. So that is why we have that kind of legislation.
Do I need to worry about the fact that the lifts are creaky and not working properly? When I get into lift, I wonder if it's going to deliver me to the top floor or plummet to the basement. Is that something the board of directors should be worried about?
Yeah, so that's the Occupational Health and Safety Act, and that simply governs safety in the workplace. If you're a director of a company, for instance, in a mining industry or a chemical industry or a heavy industry where there is a risk of injury or death, worse still, to your employees, there is an obligation to comply with that act and the regulations that are applicable to your particular industry. Again, the board would need assurance in relation to compliance with that particular act. It doesn't need to know all of the details, simply the fact that the executives are aware of what's required of them and that it is being applied. Obviously, monitoring injuries and deaths in the workplace can be a material factor, and it's often used by companies in measuring executive performance. So that is something that I think the board would be paying attention to if you're in that kind of industry where there is a possibility of injury or death.
Well, it sounds like a reasonably wide range of laws and regulations that we need to know about or need to be worried about. Is there anything else before we crack on to the next topic?
There's just one further one that I think directors are not necessarily aware of and should be aware of, and that is that in the Pension Fund Act, there is a provision that states that if the company fails to pay contributions over to the pension fund in terms of the rules of that fund, is that the directors can be personally liable for that failure to pay the contributions and obliged to pay the contributions themselves. So that can be problematic. Now, the only way that the board members can avoid that liability is if they delegate in writing the directors who are actively involved in the financial affairs of the company. And then only those directors who are actively involved face personal liability. But there is an obligation to make that disclosure in order to avoid personal liability of directors. So I think it's just something that directors aren't necessarily aware of, and that should probably be attended to.
I guess forming really part of the principle that payment towards retirement is a special category of payment. And so right at the top level, you've got to be worried about whether that's been made provision for. And that sounds like it's an obligation that goes beyond just checking that salaries are paid at the end of the month.
No, it goes beyond that. It's a form of trust money. So, you know, we have had instances where companies have been deducting contributions for workers and then not paying it over to the fund. And in other words, simply pocketing what is the employee's retirement money. Then when the company gets into trouble and the employees are out of pocket, that's a serious problem. And that is why such emphasis is placed particularly on pension fund contributions. And the same doesn't apply to remuneration. If the company doesn't pay remuneration, well, then that's another problem. It's a liability and it's another issue and another breach of the BCEA, but it doesn't have the same penalty as with the pension fund contribution issue.
Okay, brilliant. Thanks very much, Graham. We've got to get through six topics if we're going to deal with all of the ones you mentioned on the King Code. And I think the second one you mentioned was ethics. Let's talk about ethics. What do board members need to worry about? I'd like to think that any board members who might be listening to this podcast would rate ethics high up on their list of priorities. What are they worried about in relation to the company, and how are they supposed to exercise their oversight to ensure that the right standard of ethics is managed in the company?
That's interesting. The King Code has now gone and placed a considerable amount of emphasis on ethics. And I think it's because of we've had a number of corporate scandals in this country. We've had the VBS saga, where that bank went into liquidation, or I think it's still under curatorship, actually. But we've had Fidentia, we've had Steinhoff. And I think that's why there's now this emphasis on ethics. And what's required of the board is that it must set the ethical direction of the company. And we'll talk a little bit about what constitutes an ethical direction. Having set the ethical direction, it must then ensure that there are codes and policies in place that underpin that ethical direction. And then it's got an obligation to make sure that employees are actually being trained and made aware of those policies as well. So it's almost a sort of three-step thing. Set the ethical direction, make sure that the codes are in place, that the executives must put the codes in place, and then finally make sure that people actually know about it. And then I'd add one, is that you'd want to know and allow for a policy that allows people to report ethical breaches so that they are escalated in the event that there are ethical breaches occurring in the company.
Graham, setting the ethical direction of the company says to me that you could choose from a range of options. You've got a sort of you know, there's a few different paths or forks in the road ahead of me. And as the board, I must decide which path we're going to go down in relation to ethics. Does that sound right? Does the board actually pick whether how it wants to manage ethics?
That's right. I mean, look, ethics is a very broad description, and my sense of ethics may be very different to somebody else's sense of ethics, but there seem to be what would be regarded as a common set of very minimum standards of ethics, and the one would be obviously compliance with the legislation. And the other, I'd say, broad one is that you would not want your company to act in a manner, or your employees in your company to act in a manner that is harmful to other employees, that is harmful to either your suppliers or your customers, and is not harmful to the environment or the public in which you operate. So essentially, those are the sort of, I'd say, broad ethical parameters that would constitute almost a minimum standard. Beyond that, you can get into things like honesty, integrity, behave respectfully, do not discriminate, various things like that. But I'd say at the very least, it's those kind of minimums.
It's not that wide a choice then. It's fine. You can set the ethical direction of the company, but compliance with the law, acting honestly, not harming others, and broadly in support of the company stakeholders, that's the basic threshold. So a code of ethics, which I think you said was, you know, the next leg, then once you've decided on your ethical direction, a code of ethics, what's that going to entail? And the second thing is, can I write a brilliant code of ethics and I can get one written by AI and then put it in my top drawer, or the top drawer of my desk, or the bottom drawer, or the waste bin?
Yeah. So let's start with the codes of ethics. And essentially what you would do is you would have codes that basically are directed at each set of stakeholders. You would have a broad set of ethics in relation to how employees must behave generally. And that's, behave with respect, behave honestly. That's a kind of a broad set. But beyond that, in terms of how employees relate to each other, you want them to behave in an ethical way to one another. And that's in a way that does not cause harm to one another. So you can have broad principles such as treating with respect, don't discriminate, things like that. But there's now a specific requirement in our law that you have a code that deals with harassment and bullying. You do not want a situation in your company where there is harassment on any one of the recognized grounds of, be it sexual harassment, harassment on grounds of race, gender, or sexual orientation, any form of harassment along those lines. And you wouldn't want any form of bullying behavior, because bullying behaviors actually can be very harmful to employees as well. We've got a serious issue in this country, it seems to us, by the number of cases that we are called on to deal with of sexual harassment. And so I think it's imperative that you have a sexual harassment policy as well, where employees feel free to raise issues of sexual harassment and that they are properly and sensitively dealt with by the company. So those would be the kind of specific policies that would be applicable to protection of employees. You would then need, obviously, a disciplinary code and a grievance code. So the disciplinary code is to sort of regulate behavior in the workplace, so how that employees must behave to one another, how they must behave to outsiders, what they can and what they can't do, and then a grievance process so that employees are able to raise grievances where they do feel that an ethics breach is occurring.
So, Graham, that all sounds very interesting. What happens if those go in the top drawer? I mean, how do I make sure as a director that these things are not just paper? They're not just written up. I mean, it's very nice to write them up, I'm sure. I mean, you could stick them on the wall. As a director, is that enough? As long as I'm satisfied there's a document in my board pack, then I'm comfortable that we have the right policies in place.
I don't think that would be sufficient. I mean, there's a risk that happens as you adopt a beautiful set of policies and that you then do nothing about them, or you simply put them on the intranet and hope that people will access them. But that's not sufficient, I don't think. So essentially what you're going to need, and it's a question of delegation of authority, you need to delegate to your executives the obligation to ensure that people are inducted, so that new employees coming in are inducted into the policies, that there's regular updates and training of your workforce, and that the policies are accessible. And at the least, I think what the board would be wanting is some form of feedback from the executives as to what they've done in relation to induction, what they've done in relation to reminders, what they've done in relation to training, because it is such an important issue. The ethical standard of a company and setting the ethical tone is your best possibility of avoiding the kind of incident that boards have to come and see you and me about. And then we're dealing with a crisis because there's been an ethical breach or somebody's not known how to behave or something like that. So to me, it's hugely important that the board ensures that not only are these codes in place, but they are being regularly updated and that people are being trained in them.
Okay. It sounds to me what you're describing is this as a form of risk mitigation. It doesn't sound to me as though you're going to avoid those risks altogether because people are people. But what you're saying is that proper training and proper spreading of the word on ethics is likely to reduce or mitigate chances of employee behavior that's going to put the company into a crisis.
No, absolutely. I mean, it's a risk mitigation strategy. You can never, ever avoid somebody behaving badly. You know, you get a bad person, they know about your policies, they read the sexual harassment policy, and they still behave badly. And that's why we often have to deal with those kind of cases as well. But from a board's perspective, you have done your duty to ensure that you have set the right tone for the company's ethical behavior and that you actually apply it.
The last thing you mentioned, I recall, is that you have to have channels in place for people to report problems with ethics or ethics breaches. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so look, obviously the standard is to have your normal grievance process where an employee can lodge a grievance against another employee in relation to their behavior, and that grievance will be investigated. But I think more importantly, a company would want to introduce and should introduce a whistleblowing policy. Now, a whistleblowing policy is one that's been implemented in terms of the Protected Disclosures Act. The Protected Disclosures Act is there to protect people who are whistleblowers from any form of retaliation. So if somebody blows the whistle and escalates an issue where they're complaining of an ethical breach by other employees in the company, there can be no retaliation against that employee for raising that issue. The issue's got to be a serious one. It has to deal with one of these ethical things that I'm talking about. So it's got to relate to sexual discrimination or discrimination of some form, criminal conduct such as corruption or receiving of bribes. It must relate to potential damage to the environment, or it must be damage to the health and safety of employees. So in other words, there's a limited category of protected disclosures, but there has to be an ability for employees to make those kind of disclosures and for them to feel safe in doing so. So in other words, they must be able to make it to somebody where they know that it'll be investigated and they know that there won't be retaliation. Now, many companies use external providers to do that whistleblowing service. But more importantly, from a board's perspective, I think the board needs to be made aware of every whistleblowing incident, of what the company intends to do in relation to that incident, and what the final result of any investigation was. So that way, at least the board has some way of knowing whether those policies that have been put in place are actually being complied with as well.
I mean, that all makes perfect sense to me, Graham, but am I worried as a director about the risk of people abusing those kinds of facilities to settle scores? I've had a bad performance rating from my manager, and so I'm going to put in some nonsense into the whistleblowing complaint to try and smear or upset the apple cart with my manager, make her life difficult. Are we worried as directors? Are we worried about abuse of the privileges of whistleblowing?
Look, there is abuse. I mean, we have had instances, and typically somebody being performance managed may allege that they're now the victim of bullying. And then you've got to discern from those facts that are being put forward whether it is actually performance management or it is bullying. You know, a single incident of an employee being performance managed would not constitute bullying. It would have to be wider than that, and there'll have to be more evidence. And we've had the kind of standard. I've had a couple of this kind of anonymous complaint against the chief executive. He's guilty of sexual harassment, bullying, nepotism, and corruption. And then there's no facts to support it at all. But you've got to discern between the rubbish complaints and the good ones. And overall, I think that the policies do good rather than encourage bad behavior and bad reporting.
I suppose as a board member, I've got to say that there is a weighing up of that, and it's more important to me to have the channel open so that people feel safe to refer real malfeasance and
we have to sort the wheat from the chaff, and we've got to rely on our people or our external advisors to help us do that.
Just on the policy issue, I mean, look, obviously, I've dealt with employees, but you would need other policies in relation to your suppliers, that you'd have to have a proper procurement policy and one that your employees don't receive gifts, they disclose conflicts of interest. In relation to competition in particular, and this relates to your duties to your customers, that you don't engage in any form of anti-competitive behavior. And that, I know, has become a major part of policies and of training to ensure people don't breach those. But that really covers, I think, the ethics issue and the codes that are required.
The next key sort of area that I think you mentioned arising out of King is, as a board, you've actually got to appoint a chief executive officer. And in fact, it sounds as though it's particularly important because we're having to rely on the executive to do a lot of the things that we're responsible for at the board. What do we need to think about when we're appointing a chief executive?
I'm not going to mention selecting the right candidate because that's obviously critical. You get the wrong candidate, and then you're going to end up on the front page of the newspaper, as has happened with a couple of the chief executives that have gone on to behave very badly. So I'm not going to comment on selection. I'm no expert on moral behavior and the choice of the right person. Once you've chosen the right person, what we tend to find is that not sufficient attention is paid to the contract of employment that is concluded with the executive. You know, very often a standard employment contract is pulled out and that is given to the chief executive. And in my view, specific consideration needs to be given to the contract with the chief executive. And again, that's part of risk mitigation as well, that you think through the contract and the terms of the contract in order to mitigate risk to the company in relation to the chief executive's appointment.
Okay, well, what's different? What's important in a chief executive's contract? If we can't trolley out the standard that we use for everybody, why not? What's so important about the chief executive, and why is contracting with them any different?
First of all, if you focus on the remuneration side of it, there are often quite some unique features to the remuneration to a chief executive. Obviously, there's the standard normal short-term incentives, then the normal long-term incentives. But the way companies contract in relation to those incentives becomes quite important, because what you don't want to do is lock yourself into a particular short-term incentive or long-term incentive scheme and a particular formula. And you want to contract a discretion to be able to amend that. The whole sort of themes around STIs and LTIs change over time. And what's fashionable now is not going to be fashionable later. And the board needs to react to changes in the STI and LTI environment. So the drafting of those clauses around short-term incentive and long-term incentives become important. Increasingly also, companies are having to pay sign-on bonuses to chief executives. So a chief executive being recruited from another company is going to have to resign, and they're going to forfeit their long-term incentives at that company. And very often in the negotiation, they insist on being compensated in respect of the bonuses that they're going to lose at their old employer. And it's necessary then to draft that sign-on bonus clause very carefully. What you're trying to do is attempt to replicate the bonus that is being lost. So you're trying to make it vest in the time frame that would ordinarily vest. And if it's got performance conditions, you're trying to replicate those performance conditions. Drafting around that is quite important. And we've seen mistakes where they've committed to make a payment of, for instance, a replacement award on a particular date, and then have failed to say that the chief executive still has to be an employee on that particular date. And so when the chief executive left before, he then said, I'm still entitled to that particular bonus. So the drafting of the sign-on bonuses becomes critical. And then there are a couple of others that I would say are important, like the duration of the contract and notice periods.
Just on duration and notice, there was a time I understood where the King Code was suggesting that a fixed duration, that chief executives shouldn't be hired for more than a particular fixed duration, at the end of which the board then essentially has a discretion to say, is this still the right person to run the company? And we've got a fresh decision. Shall we give them another term or not? Is that still the position? Is that the right way to look at chief executive contracts?
So there is some sort of mention of the duration of a contract in King, but I think it pertains more to directorship than it pertains to the chief executive. Chief executives normally are employed on indefinite duration contracts. They're not normally employed on fixed term contracts. It's very unusual to see a fixed term contract. We used to see them when, you know, heads of government departments were appointed, that they were appointed for 5 years terms to align with the term of the parliament. And with some of the parastatals, we saw the five-year duration come in. But there's no operational reason why you would have a fixed-term contract for a chief executive. They normally are employed on an indefinite basis. They don't ordinarily last more than 7 or 8 years. But that doesn't matter. You should still have an indefinite duration contract and not a fixed-term contract, in my view.
What does that mean as a board? When I've had my chief executive for 7 or 8 years, you said that's their usual shelf life. Well, they may decide that maybe their usual shelf life because they move on to greener pastures. But maybe there aren't greener pastures and maybe they've got a little bit tired and a bit jaded. Or maybe I decide that they've done a great job until now, but I want something different. Does that present me with any problems when I want to move them on?
It does, because you don't have a basis for dismissing them. So simply because you want some fresh blood doesn't mean that that's an operational need that would require a change in the company. You would have to put it into one of those three categories that warrants termination. One, you know, being operational requirements, which is a retrenchment, which you would never retrench a CEO. They always need it. So you're either dealing with poor performance or misconduct, and you're not dealing with misconduct.
What happens if their performance is mediocre? I'm a high-performance company. I'm looking for high performance, but I've got mediocrity.
Well, then you're not setting the correct benchmarks, because if you want high performance, you've got to set those benchmarks. Then those are the performance benchmarks that the CEO has to achieve. And if he's not achieving them, then you're dealing with a poor performance. So that's what you'll deal with. But most often, those type of scenarios are dealt with through negotiation, discussion, and mutual separation agreements, which we are going to deal with in a further podcast when we talk about companies in crisis and dealing with your executives in those circumstances.
Let's not get stuck on that now then. But other provisions that are more common for chief executives that we have to worry about at a board level, again, we're looking at it from a board perspective.
So again, notice periods I think are important because you know, a standard 1 month notice is not going to be effective for a chief executive. You need proper notice that the person is going to leave in order that you can make alternative arrangements. So it's more usual to have an either 3 month or a 6 month notice period for a chief executive. 6 months is often too long because, you know, the chief executive looking for another departure is not going to want to stick around 6 months, and you're not going to want somebody who's leaving your employer to stick around 6 months. So it's more usual to look for a kind of a 3 month notice period, and that then gives you sufficient time to make an arrangement for either a successor or at least an interim arrangement for somebody to stand in. Then accompanied with your notice period, often what you'd provide is for a garden leave scenario, where if a chief executive resigns, you can place him on garden leave during that notice period. My view is that common law, you've got a right in any event to put an employee on garden leave, but I am aware that there may be arguments of a person's right to work, or particularly where there's variable remuneration, my right to earn variable remuneration. So I would draft a garden leave provision into the contract as well. Then just finally, coupled with notice periods and garden leave, I would also consider a restraint of trade and whether that is necessary. Bear in mind, your chief executive is intimately knowledgeable of your strategy, of how your business is doing, its strengths, its weaknesses. I don't think you'd want your CEO to end up with a competitor 3 months after he leaves your employer. And in that case, a restraint of trade would be warranted because of the confidential information and the potential customer connections that they have. I do think a restraint would be warranted. So those are the things I think would need to be thought about.
Graham, garden leave is an interesting proposition. Is it because chief executives spend a lot of time gardening?
No, it's simply a proposition of utilizing somebody while they are on notice. So, you know, if they have resigned and you want them out the organization, you've got the ability to place them out of the organization. So there's one other provision that I think should be carefully considered for a chief executive contract, and that's an alternative dispute resolution clause. you know, particularly with the chief executive, because bear in mind that any unfair dismissal dispute ends up in the CCMA. Once it's in the CCMA, anything you're going to disclose, the information you're going to give is in the public domain. The fight is in the public domain. It's not private. It's not confidential. From the CCMA, it potentially has got the scope to go to the Labor Court, and from the Labor Court to the Labor Appeal Court, and it can even end up in the Constitutional Court. And that can take you 8 years of litigation where all of this stuff is being aired in the public domain. So very often, companies prefer an alternative dispute resolution clause where if there is a dispute about the termination of a CEO's contract or any other interpretation issue, that it goes to private arbitration in front of a senior counsel or somebody that's suitably skilled. And that way you make sure that it's private and confidential, it's dealt with expeditiously, it's dealt with at the correct level, and that it doesn't go through the entire court processes where it's being articulated at every possible level. So I do think an alternative dispute resolution clause would be appropriate for a chief executive contract.
Graham, earlier you talked about, and I think you mentioned this in the context of the King Code, you know, sort of key principles or pillars, the importance of delegation of authority. And as I understand it, the question really is this. I sit on the board of a company, and let's assume I'm very diligent. I do a lot of work to identify the right person, and I take your advice on the contract, and I do put in all the different clauses, and I get advice on notice periods and all these kind of things. And then I say, fantastic, I've done my job. All authorities to run the company are now hereby delegated to the chief executive officer. I've got the right person. She's going to do everything that we need to have done going forward. And I can now sit back and sleep easy. Is that not fair enough? Haven't I really done my job now?
With the delegation of authority, what King refers to is that the delegation of authority must refer to role clarity. So there's got to be very clear role clarity as to what is left with the board in terms of its responsibilities and duties and what are the responsibilities and duties of the CEO. I think a broad delegation of everything I as the board is meant to do, you're meant to do, CEO, is not going to be or contribute to role clarity. I think it's going to have to be a far more detailed delegation than that. And there are also other areas of specific delegation where there is going to be a joint form of responsibility. So take the appointment of the executives for the executive committee. Is the board needs to be assured that the person being appointed has got the right competency. So although this CEO has the delegated authority to appoint the right person, there's still an oversight role by the board. And so you've got to have that kind of role clarity. So, no, I think you've got to be a lot more specific in your delegation. And then I'll mention also in terms of monitoring that the CEO is doing what has been delegated to them, because I don't think that you can simply abrogate your duties once they're delegated and simply sit back and say, well, I've delegated, I don't need to worry anymore. I think you have to monitor that delegation. There is a requirement that the board does performance management or performance appraisals of the CEO. And part of that appraisal and performance management would be assuring itself that the duties that are delegated are actually being carried out.
Okay, no, that's great. I mean, I was thinking while you were talking about the fact, of course, that the chief executive is not himself going to actually do everything, because they're going to appoint other people with different responsibilities. Am I worried about that as the board, when the chief executive says, don't worry, I'll handle everything. I'm going to appoint five people reporting to me, each of whom is going to do a piece of what we need to do to run the company?
Correct. Well, that's standard practice, is that there will be further delegations down to the respective executives. But it's not the board's concern as to how the chief executive is delegated, because similarly to the board's responsibility, the CEO can't abrogate the responsibility once he's delegated. He still has to assure himself that what is being delegated is being done. So you can rely on the fact that you've delegated it to him, and although he's sub-delegated it, he's still responsible.
Well, that's fine, but don't I also have to check that the people that the chief executive's appointed are competent?
Only that they're competent. So at the time of their appointment, you have to assure yourself that they are competent and skilled enough to do the jobs for which they're being appointed. But beyond that, the performance management of those executives, ensuring that they do their work, all of that is the role of the CEO, and the board should not be involved in performance managing, disciplining the executives below the CEO level, because otherwise you're undermining his authority. And he's going to say, if his performance is ever criticized, but you board abrogated my role and responsibilities, and I'm not responsible.
Graham, you talked about the board having to keep an eye on things, continue to monitor, provide oversight, check that the CEO is doing exactly what you've asked them to do under that delegation of authority. Just some thoughts about how you do that, because it sounds easier said than done.
It's really performance appraisal. So, you know, a lot of the performance appraisals focus on key performance areas and with a lot of financial metrics and other maybe performance metrics and then KPIs in relation to those particular metrics and measurements around that. I do think that there's a part of the performance appraisal that looks at the delegated responsibilities and how they're actually being performed and what is being done in relation to those. So, you know, where you've delegated responsibility for instance, the production of codes to govern ethics. Have those codes been produced? Are they in place? Is there compliance training going on? All of those kind of areas of delegation should be checked on.
Some people might find this kind of a chit-chat between lawyers a little dry, talking about contracts, policies, codes. Remuneration is a little bit sexier for many people, and so maybe that is a good topic for us to turn to at the end of our session. You said something about King saying the board sets the remuneration strategy and so on. What do we have to do about this? Why do we care?
No, you're right. So look, remuneration attracts a huge amount of attention and normally adverse attention, particularly where the payments being made to executives are regarded as being out of the ordinary or too much, or, you know, they certainly sort of attract attention because they have some eye-watering numbers in relation to their executive remuneration. So it is a topic that attracts attention. And particularly, we've had instances where shareholders have not voted in favor of remuneration policies, and that blows back on the board. So there is obviously a lot of focus on the area, and that makes it more kind of interesting because of the stuff that goes on around it. But from a board's responsibility in terms of King is that what the board is required to do, it's required to set the board broad principles applicable to pay and remuneration. So it sets the direction of pay, and then obviously it has to determine, it's got a lot of powers in relation to the various variable pay, short-term incentive schemes and long-term incentive schemes, which it has to apply on an annual basis.
Why does this topic attract so much attention? So you talked about eye-watering numbers. Perhaps human beings are obsessed with money and finance and wealth, and that it makes it a sort of an interesting topic or a topic that attracts attention. But also there's growing awareness across the world of, I think it's just called the wage gap, the growing distance between what chief executives earn and what ordinary people in the street are paid. And in South Africa, it's been a particular question about looking at what essentially low-paid workers, the lowest levels of pay, and what those jobs earn and are compensated for, and what the top pay. So there's a thing called the Gini coefficient, which measures that gap, and that also creates a lot of attention. So maybe I can ask you this. Why does a company pay chief executive so much, and how do I work out what's enough?
Yeah, so look, that sets, I suppose, the direction of pay and the broad policies that the remuneration committee should set in relation to pay. Essentially, you're looking at the market in which you're competing for people. So you're looking at your competitors and you're looking at what the benchmarks are in relation to your industry in which you operate. What has happened is that overseas executive pay has gone up hugely over the past decade or so. And to a large degree, we're mirroring what is happening overseas. And then we've got on top of that the added problem that the rand has depreciated in relation to dollars and pounds, which other executives overseas are earning. So if you are competing in an international market for your executives, well, then we are starting to pay the kind of benchmarks that the overseas firms are paying, and then our pay becomes very, very high in rand terms. So that's one of the kind of issues that I think is giving rise to the kind of complaints that we're starting to see. And the pay gap issue that you mentioned is an issue. And the Companies Act is in the process of being amended so that there's now going to be reporting obligations on the pay gap.
Okay, so I understand that point about the pay gap and the market. But don't I also have to see that I get value for money? In other words, I suppose, do I commit to what I pay my chief executive large amounts of money now and hope that she performs? Or do I link the two? How do I see at the board level, and how am I satisfied that I'm getting value for money? And I suppose that might lead into questions about how much money do I guarantee and how much money do I say you only get if you really do a good job?
Yeah, so you're right. There's been a kind of change and more focus on variable pay. So there's sort of less guaranteed pay and more variable pay. And the variable pay is intended to align pay with performance. And that is done through two mechanisms usually. You normally have a short-term incentive scheme, which rewards performance in a year. And there you have a set of performance benchmarks for your performance during that year. And there's a bonus paid in relation to achievement of those particular benchmarks. And then you have a long-term incentive scheme where what you're trying to do is, well, first of all, attract, retain, and motivate staff. But there you're trying to align the value to the growth in shareholder value. So you try to align your employee and executive remuneration with growth in shareholder value, and you try to align the two. And then you lock in employees over the longer term. So these normally vest in periods of either 3 or 5 years, so that employees, in order to earn those bonuses, need to remain in your employer. And they're normally now also linked to performance over those 3 and those 5 years. So you don't encourage short-term performance over a year where the executives simply focus on 1 year's performance. They need to focus on performance over the longer term in order to earn those awards. And those awards are the ones where the real value of executive pay falls.
Graham, it sounds as though in some of these areas, especially where you're linking pay to performance, whether it's in the shorter term or the longer term, that there may be a role or an important role for members of the board to exercise a discretion to decide whether or not objectives have been met, to decide whether or not shares should vest, or to decide whether or not if something's been paid on a certain basis and it turns out that that basis is actually wrong, that the company's entitled to claim back what it might have promised, already paid rather.
Yeah.
I mean, are those things that a board still gets to monitor, or does a board sign up early and say, there's a whole lot of objective criteria and you can ask the mathematicians to tell you whether it's due or not? I suppose I'm interested in whether the board has an ongoing role in monitoring, determining, and deciding on the payment of incentives short and long term.
It's a constant, because there's a whole lot of discretions that the board needs to exercise. And this is particularly so in relation to both the SDI performance measures, which the board will need to sign off on, but more importantly, in relation to the long-term incentives. So for the long-term incentives, the board is afforded a whole range of discretions. They've got to decide who participates in the LTI. It's got to sign off on the amount of the awards that are being made to people in terms of the LTI. It's got to set those performance criteria, and it's got to monitor and assess those performance criteria. It may need to exercise the discretion, if the rules permit, to amend those. It then has to deal with, you know, bad leaver, good leaver scenarios, which is normally automatic, but it may need to exercise the discretion on a mutual termination. And then finally, increasingly, schemes have introduced what are called malus and clawback provisions. Now, a malus provision is that provides that where an award is not yet vested and an employee does something wrong, or you find that the metrics on which you measured performance to give him that award were wrong, you can take back that award. A clawback provision allows you, once an employee has left your employer or got the award, to claw it back in the event that you find the calculation was wrong or the financials have been misstated. So the board has to be involved in this whole process, from award to the end of the award, or potentially after the award, we may need to claw it back. So there are a variety of things that need to be done.
So are these discretions that are in my, I can decide absolutely, nobody can question them? Or as a board member, do I have to be concerned that at some point, if I decide to exercise that discretion one way or another, I decide that actually this employee hasn't met the criteria that I thought they would need to achieve a long-term incentive, to allow a long-term incentive to vest or something of that kind. Is there any external scrutiny of my decisions there?
No discretion now is absolute, and every discretion has to be exercised rationally and reasonably and ultimately give rise to a fair outcome, because under the unfair labor practice provisions, unfair conduct in relation to a bonus or variable pay can be scrutinized by the CCMA, and a commissioner can replace your award with his or her award in the event that they believe you've acted unreasonably or irrationally or unfairly. So the board has to be very careful in the exercise of that discretion, and certainly should not act in any form of arbitrary manner in relation to those kind of awards. Otherwise, you face a real risk of being overturned at the CCMA, which also raises why you should potentially have alternative dispute resolution clauses for these kind of awards as well.
Well, Grab, that takes us full circle, because you started off telling us how important it was to know broadly what the Labor Relations Act says that affects staff. And it seems like when we get to the end of our pay discussion, we circle back to being concerned that a commissioner might scrutinize our discretionary decisions on pay under powers given to them under the Labor Relations Act. Maybe that's a good point to close off then. What's left for me is to say thank you very much. I'm looking forward very much to our next episode, when we're going to discuss some of the challenges when things go badly wrong. And I look forward to that conversation with you very much. Fantastic to have you share your experience with us. And thank you very much.
If you would like to get in touch or find out more about Bowmans, please visit bowmanslaw.com.